This program is brought to you by PersonalLifeMedia.com.
Welcome to Dishy Mix. I'm your host, Susan Bratton. And on today's show, you are going to get to meet again Sir Ken Robinson. Sir Ken was on the show, probably about a year and a half ago, and he has been one of my all-time most popular guests. Month after month after month, he's in the top of the downloads. And he has a brand new book out, and we're going to talk about that. Sir Ken is an international leader in human potential, in creativity, and education, and the intersection of those things. Yes, education can be creative. He has a new book out. It's called The Element, How Finding Your Passion Changes Everything. And he's really one of the world's leaders in creativity and innovation. And we're going to focus on bringing that to the way we consider ourselves and the way we consider those with whom we work. So I'd like to introduce and welcome Sir Ken Robinson. Welcome.
Thank you, Susan. It's a great pleasure to be back. Thank you.
I'm so happy you are. And I wanted to start out, Sir Ken, with the notion that when I read your book, I really felt like what you did was kick open the door to a new realm of talent assessment tools. It was like popped into a whole new place where there was so much more for me to understand about myself and the people that I love and work with, about their talents and their capabilities. You referenced a lot of people's work and stitched it together with your own special spin and look at humans and their unique ways of being, that I hope we can cover a lot of that today. So the first thing that I want to do is I want you to describe the element for us. Give us that level set.
Okay, well, the element, the title comes from an expression that a lot of people use, and I hear myself saying, you know, which is that people do their best when they do the thing they love, when they're in their element. And I thought, well, what is that exactly? Because it's clear to me in my experience that an awful lot of people do things for a living that they don't really like doing, they don't much enjoy it. They just get on with it because they have found their way into it. And, you know, they live their lives in a kind of low-grade sense of tolerance with what they do. And yet, I also meet lots of people who absolutely love what they do and couldn't really imagine doing anything else. You know, they're in their element, so to speak. Well, it's two things, it seems to me. One of them is, to be in your element, you have to be doing something that you have a natural aptitude for, a natural feel. And the truth is, we all have very, very different aptitudes. You know, we take to things in very different ways. But it's not enough to be doing something you're good at, because I know lots of people who do things they're good at that they don't really much like doing. To be in your element, you have to love it too. And if you are doing something you're good at and that you also love to do, that seems to me to be the perfect place, and that's what being in your element is.
So it's the intersection of your talent and your passion.
Yes.
And that was the point in the book. It doesn't matter what your talents are if you don't love them. If you're really good at numbers and they bore you to death, don't do it. If you love plants and growing things and that's your passion and it's a part of your talent, that's where you should be.
I think that's right. That's right. And it applies definitely to people in all sorts of different walks of life. You know, for some people it's maths, for some people it's working with people, it's teaching, it's doing what you're doing now, you know, it could be cooking or raising families or anything at all. I mean, our aptitudes are very different, and that's in a way a major point of the book. You know, the book is really about diversity and celebrating difference.
So one of the things that I wanted to quote was this. You wrote, "The best hope for the future is to develop a new paradigm of human capacity to meet a new era of human existence." I think that goes to what you're saying, that every one of us has a unique talent. You know, you've been very critical of our education system being a part of the industrial revolution mechanism. You know, we are thinking about people's talents and pigeonholing them as well. And you want to get out of that and find a lot of new ways. What are some of the things that we can do as people who manage other people, for example, to create this new era of human existence?
The shift I'm talking about, as you say, is from an old model, not just of education, but of the mind, to a richer model. You know, our current systems of education are intended to develop our abilities for work, among other things. But the way in which it's done is rooted so much in the 19th century models of industrial manufacture that most people now, I think, never truly discover their own talents through the process of being educated. I have lots of people in the book. I've interviewed all kinds of people in the arts, in sciences, in business, in not-for-profits. And many of them didn't do well at school at all. They went on to do brilliantly well afterwards once they'd discovered their real talents. I don't mean to say that in order to succeed, you have to have failed at school first. You know, I mean, that would be pushing this a bit far. But it is true that education is designed to identify certain sorts of talents and not all talents. That's, by the way, traditional education at its best. The problem now, I think, is that our school systems have become so oppressed and stifled by systems of standardized testing that they're not even succeeding in their traditional market, so to speak. So a lot of people come through the system never really knowing what they're good at.
Yeah.
And I think for companies and organizations and for parents and families, what I'm trying to argue for is we have to go back and think very differently about the nature of human intelligence and the nature of human ability. We've grown up with a whole set of ideas that we take for granted about our natural abilities. And the result of it is I think we have a very impoverished view of our own potential. And I think companies have a very impoverished view very often of the real talents that are lying there in the people they employ.
I have to say, Ken, I pulled my daughter, who's now just turned 12, out of an expensive academic prep school here in the Silicon Valley because it was literally beating the life out of her. I mean, she doesn't follow, her talent set is the antithesis of that kind of rote academic memorization. And I could see her life being strangled by this school I was paying so much money for. I put her in public school. She came home the first day and said, "Mom, I love it." Their first project was to understand what kind of a learner they were. Were they auditory, kinesthetic, you know, visual? Where were their strengths? And I thought, this is a perfect kind of an education for my kids. So much more open about doing things the way that you need to express them. You know, as long as you understand the concept, express it the way you want to express it. I loved that.
It's great, Susan. I mean, we have a lot of things in common. And we have that in common, too. We took our daughter out of school when she was 16 for the same reason. You know, the light was going out in her eyes.
Yeah.
The school had become a production facility for college, and particularly for the Ivy League. And, you know, she's a great and beautiful and smart and witty girl, but she was just dying at this school. And I remember I went in to see some of the teachers at one point, and I remember one of the teachers saying, you know, we think Kate has a problem of attitude.
That's what they were telling my daughter, too. And I thought, yeah, because you're beating the crap out of her.
Right.
She was so marginalized.
I said, what's the problem? Because, you know, I mean, some teenagers have attitudes.
Yeah.
And they all do sometimes. But she doesn't as a general rule.
Right.
Not in the sense that people normally mean that.
Yeah.
You know? She's a really engaged and interesting girl. And I said, what do you mean she's got a problem of attitude? And this teacher said, well, she looks bored all the time. And I said to her, do you have any theories about that? She said, how do you mean? I said, well, could it be boring?
Right.
And of course it was.
Of course.
I'd been with this teacher 5 minutes and I was stultified. You know?
Right.
I said, no, you are boring. You know, I don't mean to say that, you know, education has to be a constant entertainment and variety show.
No.
But the gift of a teacher is to engage people's interests and to do what these teachers are doing with your daughter. To first figure out, well, how do you learn? You know, what's your style? I mean, my daughter, Kate, is a very visual learner. You know, she's great with words, but she isn't great at remembering lists of things. But if you do a mind map, she totally gets it.
Right.
And the other thing, by the way, and I don't know if it's true of your daughter, but the other thing is education and consequently, I think, the way we select people for employment is obsessed with a particular type of academic ability.
Right.
And, you know, academic ability is important, but it leads to this idea that if you work with your hands, so to speak, or you haven't gone off and done a law degree, then you're a lower order of person. And I think it's absolute obscenity. I was up in Danville recently doing a book signing for The Element, and there was a guy in front of me. I was signing the book very quickly, you know, the way you do. And I said, what do you do? He was in his 30s, and he said, I'm a fireman. I said, oh, great. I said, when did you decide to be a fireman? He said, I always wanted to be a fireman. He said, actually, it was interesting to me at school because, you know, when you're a kid, like, everybody wants to be a fireman. And he said, but the thing was, I really did want to be a fireman. And he said, people never took me seriously. And even at high school, everyone was getting, you know, prepped and pushed and told they had to go to college. And he said, I didn't want to do that. He said, and I had one teacher who said to me, you know, you'll never amount to anything if that's your attitude. And he called me stupid in front of the whole class. He said, I never forgot that.
Crushing.
He said, anyway, he said, about 6 months ago, I saved his life. He was in a car accident. I pulled him out and I gave him CPR. He said, I think he thinks better of me now. You know?
Right.
If all we had was academic ability or the, you know, the capacity to complete certain types of academic programs, the world would have stopped generations ago. You know, we depend upon not just a variety of talents among all of us, but within each of us. And what we have here is a process of education which takes, you know, smart and sparkling kids like your daughter and flattens them out. You know, and then they think it's their fault, or they put them on drugs to try and get them back with the program. You know, I just think that what we really have to realize is the world is heading towards some of the greatest challenges that have ever faced us as a species. I mean that really seriously. And the way that we're going to cope with this is not with some old-fashioned, taken-for-granted view of human talent. We have to get right back to basics. When people talk about getting back to basics, I wish they would, you know. And that's why we call the book The Element, in part, because the other reason, the resonance of the term, is it's elemental. It's absolutely fundamental. We get back to think of what we are as human beings, what we have to offer, and what we now have to develop if we're to make really genuine progress into the future.
Well, one of my favorite things about your book was the various kinds of talent assessment tools that you talked about. And I want to cover quite a few of those, but I have a question for you first. Because not everyone understands what their real talents are. We must go through a process of self-assessment and have others, you know, that love us and know us well, give us some clues as to what they might think are our talents as well. I'd recently interviewed Marcus Buckingham. He's the author of The Truth About You. And one of the things that he offered in his book was a process for getting to understand what your talents might be by keeping a diary of your day whenever you were doing something that made you feel really good, you'd write it down. And whenever you were just doing something that made you feel really bad, you'd write it down. And over the course of a couple of weeks, you could begin to look at those moments when you were in your element as a way to help you. What other tools or techniques do you think are good for people who think, I don't know the intersection of my talent and my passion. I just have no idea. I'm completely lost.
Yeah. Well, the first thing is that there is a difference between aptitude and passion, clearly. You know, an aptitude to me is a natural ability in something. You know, a sense that you know what this is, that you can do it relatively easily. I don't mean you can become an expert in something instantly, but you know what it is. I interviewed lots of people in the book, and you know, some of them are musicians. They just took to music immediately. Some are mathematicians. They got it right away that this is what maths was about. One of the people I interviewed in the book was a guy called Bart Connor. Bart is, I think, an extraordinary guy. He discovered when he was six that he could walk on his hands as easily as he could walk on his feet. I mean, it wasn't much use to him, you know, but he enjoyed doing it, and it made him popular. But his parents eventually took note of this, and when he was, I think, 10, his mother took him to a gymnastics center in his hometown of Morton Grove, Illinois. And he went every day. He said, when he went into this gymnasium, to him it was like a combination of Santa's Grotto and Disneyland. Well, you know, not all of us, Susan, feel that when we walk into a gymnasium. You know, I don't.
Nor do I.
But he said it was intoxicating. I said, I need to get intoxicated if I go into a gymnasium.
But, exactly. We'll be at the pub next door.
Anyway, you know, 8 years later, he walked onto the mat of the Montreal Olympics representing the United States in the male gymnastics squad. And he went on to become the most decorated male gymnast in American history. He now lives in Oklahoma. He's married to Nadia Comaneci, you know, the first perfect 10 in women's gymnastics. They run this extraordinary gymnastics school, and they're great champions of the Special Olympics movement. Well, you know, this was clearly a natural capacity that Bart demonstrated at an early age. But of course, he wasn't able at the age of six to go straight to the gym, to the Olympics. There's a huge process that then has to take place to develop these capacities into something. But we all have them very differently. That's really my point. And you're quite right. I think it's not even that some people don't know. Most people don't know what their real talents are or their natural aptitudes, because the opportunity to develop them isn't presented. You know, I mean, if Bart had had a different mother, somebody else might have said, Bart, will you stop it with the hands thing? You know, and get on with your homework. But here was somebody who recognized that this was an important part of who this kid was. So there are lots of tests out there, and I'm actually looking at a whole range of these just now, which are designed. I mean, Marcus Buckingham has his own schedule for this, of finding your strengths. There are lots of different systems out there which are designed to help people to think about both how they learn, you know, whether they're dominantly visual or auditory learners or verbal learners, but also tests for, physical dexterity, for visual acuity, for sound, for all the whole panoply of human aptitudes. It has been looked at really quite extensively over a long time and produced some tests which I think are interesting, some which are perhaps less interesting. So I do recommend that. I do recommend to people that they do, as Marcus says, they should keep a note of things that they do, things they find come easy to them, things they find are less easy. But also alongside that, my point about the element is it's about things we also enjoy doing. And I think keeping track of that is really very important. I know Terry, my wife, always says to me, if I spent a day doing administration and I come in for dinner, I look like I've aged about 10 years. You know, because, I mean, I do it. I don't like it, but I do it. But if I've been out working with people all day, I come back in, looking 10 years younger. And this is a really interesting point to me, that if you're doing something you love, it gives you energy. And if you do things you don't like, it takes energy from you. Energy is not fixed, I think. It's something that's generated by your excitement about the thing that you're doing. I'm sure it's true for you. If you have a really good series of interviews, you get jazzed by it. You get energized by it. You might be physically tired, but you could go on all day, you know?
Absolutely. And we are going to go on for a little while longer, but first we're going to take a break to thank our sponsors. And when we come back, I want to talk to you about more about the energy and being in the flow and some of these other aptitude decipherers. That's hard to say. So let's take a break. You're getting to know Sir Ken Robinson. He's an international leader in the human potential, creativity, and education. And he has a new book called The Element, How Finding Your Passion Changes Everything. And of course, Sir Ken is going to be so kind as to give us two personally autographed copies for Dishy Mix listeners. To get yours and to be one of the people that we choose for Sir Ken to give you your personally autographed copy, all you need to do is go to my Dishy Mix Facebook fan club. That's at dishymixfan.com. Takes you right there. Just post on the wall your desire to have a copy, and we'll choose from two of you and get those out to you. Sir Ken, thank you for offering that up. I appreciate it.
Pleasure.
All right, we're going to go to break, thank my sponsors, listen to their messages. Some of them are very timely and offer great discounts for you, which I know you'll appreciate. We'll be right back with more of Sir Ken and All About You.
Hey, this is Sean Daly, host of Green Talk Radio. Green Talk helps you navigate the maze of green and eco products on the market today and make smarter lifestyle choices at home and at work through informative and entertaining interviews with industry authors and experts, as well as executives from innovative companies around the world. Find Green Talk Radio on iTunes or at personallifemedia.com. Green Talk Radio, environmental stewardship through smart consumption. Green Talk Radio.
We're back, and before the break, we were talking with Sir Ken Robinson about his new book, The Element. And Sir Ken, you were talking about energy, and one of the things you discussed in the book was Dr. Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi. Thank you for making that spelled out so that I could pronounce it.
Yeah, I do know him, by the way, and the answer's to Mike.
Mike is good.
I would go for that.
He talks about flow, the psychology of optimal experience. How do you tie that into finding your element?
Well, the way I put it in the book is that I use the expression being in the zone. And what I mean by that is that when you're doing something that you're naturally good at and that you also love to do, there are moments there where I think the level of absorption becomes so intense that time changes for you. You see, this idea of getting into the element to me is really important for a whole range of reasons. One of them is it's essential to our personal fulfillment, because it's about, in a way, discovering who we really are, you know, discovering the things in a sense that we were born to do. And you have a feel for when you're doing something that resonates deeply with your sense of self, because you feel often that you're most authentic when you're doing it. You feel that you're most natural. You think, oh, this is me when I'm doing this. Now, the most intense experience of that, I think, is what Mike Csikszentmihalyi calls flow, and what I call in the book being in the zone. What I mean by that is you're being in the deep heart of it at that point. I find it sometimes, or most often, truthfully, if I'm working with people, I think I talk a little bit about this there, you know, that I get asked to talk a lot about these things and to work with groups. And sometimes, you know, if the energy's right and you're really connecting with the room, you know, you can look up and it's an hour later and you didn't realize the time had gone that quickly. You know, if you're doing things you love to do, an hour can feel like 5 minutes. If you're not doing things that you feel really tuned to, 5 minutes can feel like an hour, which is, I'm sure, how your daughter was feeling at the school she left behind her.
Yeah.
You know, time just drags and you think, will this clock never move? One of the people I interviewed in the book is a great woman called Ava Lawrence, who is one of the world's leading women pool players. It's a very interesting story. But she says even now, you know, she's been playing for over 30 years professionally. She can be at the pool table and she doesn't know if it's been 9 hours or 20 minutes. She gets so lost and absorbed in the process. You find it when people... My wife, Terry, is a writer, and, I mean, she loses track of time completely. She can be writing for 4 hours and look up and think it was half an hour. It's that sense that you've become lost and absorbed in the process, because it's something that identifies in a very deep sense with who you are. It really tunes into your own most natural energy.
Well, it's funny that you would make a note of the book writing. I love doing Dishy Mix. I love doing interviews. I love preparing for them. I love thinking about you and the things that I want to know.
You love thinking about me.
I love thinking about you before you come on the show. And I love thinking about what it is that you know that I can ask you about that will make a difference in the lives of the people who listen to my show. Like I'm the medium. I like to channel you for them. And I love to have a talk show. I'm in my element when I do a talk show. And I decided to write a book about being a talk show host, because I've done hundreds of shows and I take great pride in my work. And it's so funny because I'm now writing this ebook with associated files that you get to listen to other talk show hosts and their strategies and all kinds of things, but writing a book about how to be a talk show host. And it's at talkshowtips.com. And it's so funny because when I write the book about it, I love writing the book about it too. I'm having so much fun writing about what I love. So I think I have the passion of writing it as well as the passion of doing it.
And that's great, you know, because there's no sense at all that we're limited to one thing or another.
Right.
I mean, some
great
people
point.
Get that deep sense doing several different things. And for some, you know, it's more one thing than another, or it's something at different times. You know, and it's really great if you can make your living doing this.
Yes, I'm so lucky.
To make is it, this isn't just that you have to do this for a living. I know lots of people who have a real passion for something, but they don't want to do it for a living. They want to keep it separate. It's something that deeply enriches their lives and actually makes what they do for a living all the more bearable for that. You know, mm-hmm. It's about having it in your life somewhere.
Well, I'm lucky that I get to do it for a living.
Yeah.
Here's a perfect segue. Harvard psychologist Howard Gardner, you talk about him in the book. You have some issues with IQ tests, certain kinds of IQ tests, and others that you think are better. And you like this idea of measuring multiple intelligences. Can you name some of those Howard Gardner multiple intelligences so we can get to thinking bigger about what our intelligence and what our talents are?
Well, yeah, I can, yes, but let me just back up a little bit on it first. The big point I'm trying to make in the book around this idea of aptitude is that one of the reasons that people don't discover their own aptitudes is because we often end up with a very narrow idea of what the possibilities are. I mean, I ask people a lot in sessions I do around the world, something which strikes me as really interesting. I ask them how many senses they think they have.
Oh, I love this. I love this part of the book. Thank you for talking about it.
Well, you know, most people, if you say, how many senses have you got? You know, without
they say five.
They'll say, we've got five, you know, without missing a beat, you know, like, what's your problem? And then I'll push them and say, well, do you have any more? And normally somebody will say, or several people say, well, yes, we've got six. And I say, what's that? And they say, well, it's like intuition. So people think you've got sight and smell and touch and hearing and taste. You know, they're the five regular senses. And then there's this other one. And I say, well, look, there's a difference between the first five and the six, because the first five all have organs that do it, like eyes and ears and tongues. And, you know, it's not quite clear what does intuition. It's a kind of spooky sense, you know, that girls have more of, apparently. Well, you know, when you push people, you say, well, do you have any more? And mostly you just draw a blank on that. People say, no, that's it. Well, you know, a physiologist will tell you you have at least nine real senses. One of them, and I talk a lot about this, is the sense of balance. Balance is absolutely fundamental to our functioning in the world.
And works well for the Olympic gymnast.
Well, it's interesting, you see, because when I said to Bart, we had dinner one night, and I asked him about the senses, and he came up with five and six. I said, do you have any more? I said, no. So I went through this. I said, well, what about balance? And he said, oh, my God, of course. You know, because the whole process of being alive and moving around and being in the world depends upon a sense of physical balance, which is mediated by the inner ear. But there's another sense, which is often thought of as kinesthesia. Physiologists call it proprioception, which is our understanding of where we are in space, you know, where our limbs are. And Bart recognized that. He said, yes, actually gymnasts call that air sense. But then there's a sense of pain, which is different from a sense of touch. And the other one is a sense of temperature, which is different again from touch. You know, we can't live without outside of a certain band of temperatures. Well, my point is that if we underestimate something as basic as the senses that we have, you know, if we've grown up thinking there are five and there are at least nine, well, what else are we taking for granted that might be wrong? And one of them is the idea of intelligence. You know, we've all grown up in a system, in a culture that's encouraged us to think that intelligence is the thing that gets measured on an IQ test. You know, people wander around, you know, feeling very proud of themselves if they score over 120 on an IQ test. Well, IQ tests do measure something. It's a variable, by the way. It seems to change and move around a fair amount. But it's not the whole of intelligence by a long way. You know, it doesn't even begin to engage with some things that Howard talks about, Howard Gardner, you know, about musical intelligence, or the things I'm just talking about, you know, about
spatial
kinesthesia, you know, physical coordination, things of those sorts. And the reason is that we have an industry built around a form of intelligence testing, which is based in, I believe, a very narrow view of human ability and capacity. So the beginning of all this, I think, is of helping people to understand that they already have very much more than they've been brought up to think they have. A lot of people think if you can't do well on an academic test, well, you're not very intelligent. But it interests me how many entrepreneurs I speak to who had no real interest in those sorts of tests at all, but have gone on to be wildly successful afterwards. Some of the most successful people in where you're speaking from now in Silicon Valley, you know, dropped out because they weren't engaged by that type of thinking. But they've become wonderfully successful in some other way. So it is, that's what I mean about the idea of promoting diversity through the book. I mean, Howard Gardner, you know, to answer your question, talks about there being seven main forms of intelligence. I think he went on to eight. I think he's also said there might be a ninth now. Now, the thing is, I do say in the book that I don't really want to argue about whether there are eight or nine or 10 or 15, really. That's just another way of thinking about it. What I want to argue is that intelligence is diverse and multifaceted, and different people carve it up in different ways. Some people say there's three, four, five. You know, to me, that's not really the point. What I'm trying to do is to get people to realize there is much more to the intelligence than this single idea that gets measured on a linear IQ test.
Yeah, there were a lot in there. You had the Robert Sternberg from Tufts. He's kind of an anti-IQ guy. He said, you know, there's analytic intelligence, which is what the IQ tests primarily cover, but there's creative intelligence and practical intelligence. Yeah. You also talked about the Herman Brain Dominance Instrument being even better than a Myers-Briggs, which is most people know about Myers-Briggs, the idea that there's a cerebral brain and a limbic brain. You know, that's kind of the interpersonal things that you can connect with people, that maybe that intuition about people or that that personal connection. Some people are very strong at that, and that's completely marginalized in IQ tests and academic education.
I think that's right. I mean, I have issues with all these different categories.
You don't like anything to be stereotyped, I know, but yeah.
I mean, I think Robert Sternberg's done great work, you know, but I have issues around distinguishing analytic from creative, because creativity involves a great deal of critical thinking and a lot of practical work, too. You know, in a way, it people carve the cake up differently, but what I'm trying to argue for is the cake is much bigger than most people think, and there's much more in it than most people think. And much more to intelligence than a conventional IQ test can ever properly begin to assess. But we are in a world still where people think that. I mean, for example, the whole area of intuition. Yeah, I know, you know, from my own life, I'm sure you do, that you have profound senses of other people, profound senses of the opportunities that present you, you know, which you can only really describe as intuitive, which aren't rational, but it doesn't mean they're wrong. They may be non-rational, but they're not irrational. I mean, when you meet people, you often find you have a genuinely positive or negative sense about your connection to them, which you can't explain in some form or way, but which probably often turns out to be true. You know, there is very much more to human intelligence and sensibility than has so far been even broached by the most sophisticated systems of testing. And I remember one thing I was very struck by. I was talking about being in a natural history museum, you know, and about how if you go into a natural history museum, you can see all these different species pinned up on the walls. You know, there's one room you can go in, there's a lot of butterflies pinned up, and, you know, over the other side of the room, you see all the spiders, and the other side, all the arachnids, you know, the other spiders, insects. But the thing is, it's a way of thinking about it. But when you go in the world, that's not how it is. You don't see all the spiders keeping to themselves on one side of the field and all the butterflies flying off somewhere else. You know, in nature, these things are all connected. And that's really my point, that when we come to examine our own capacities and our intelligence and our own abilities, there are systems of classification, but they're only that. You know, it's a way of thinking about it. And what I'm trying to do, I think, is just shift the frame a little bit and say, well, can we think about this differently? Because our feelings are intimately connected to what we know, and what we know is intimately connected to our intuition, and so on. And I think that for most organizations, we have a pretty poor way of tapping into that richness in our people.
I made a little connection between two things that I want to share with you. In The Element, you wrote about Robert Cooper. He's the author of The Other 90%. And I'm just going to read this small paragraph from your book. He says that we shouldn't think of intelligence as happening only in the brain, in our skulls. He talks about the heart brain and the gut brain. Whether we have a direct experience, he says, it does not go directly. Oh, whenever we have a direct experience, he says, it does not go directly to the brain in our heads. The first place it goes is to the neurological networks of the intestinal tract and heart. He describes the first of these, the enteric nervous system, as the second brain inside the intestines, which is independent of but also interconnected with the brain in the cranium. He says that this is why we often experience our first reaction to events as a gut reaction. Whether or not we acknowledge them, he says, our gut reactions shape everything we do. Now, I also, let me stitch these two things together for you. I recently interviewed Dacher Keltner. Ken, do you know Dacher? Have you heard of him yet?
I've heard, yes, but I don't know him.
You've got to get his book. It's called Born to be Good, The Science of a Meaningful Life. One of Dacher's, he has a book full of great research that he's pulled from everywhere. You do that really well. He does that really well. And one other author, Dr. Perricone, Nicholas Perricone, he's an anti-aging and beauty guy. He makes like face lotions and things. He pulls research from bodies of work all over the world as well, and turns it into a new framework for thinking. And the three of you are really good at that. Three books that I think are just A plus for kind of busting open our consciousness into a whole new room, a whole new place with a lot more to think about. And what Dacher said was one of the things he talked about were vagal superstars. The vagus nerve is a nerve that goes from the top of your, it goes from your brain all the way down into your gut.
That's right.
And he said that he believes that somehow, I guess the cellular makeup of that system is the thing that helps people have empathy and connect to people and get intuition, or that, you know, interpersonal, intrapersonal processing that Howard Gardner talks about being one of the ways that we can be really strong, that there are certain people who are vagal superstars. And when I read in this book about Robert Cooper and the other 90%, I thought, I think they're all kind of talking about the same thing. And there's so many people who have that level of talent, and it has those talents don't have a very, you know, good, they're good with people, they're people persons, or, but there's something there that I'm excited about, and I'm stitching it together from multiple places.
Yes. No, I think this is really important. You know, I remember saying a talk I gave at the TED conference, making that point that that most people think of their body is a form of transport for their head. And it is true, if you look at conventional views of intelligence, it all kind of suggests that intelligence is only located within your skull. And what all these insights are pointing to is something that we ought to just recognize anyway, and I should never have forgotten, which is that we are complete organisms. You know, that the way we think and feel isn't just what happens within our skull. We are embodied organisms. You know, we live in a body with a whole range of senses which are connected to each other and to how we think and how we feel. And we're also connected to each other, not just within ourselves, but to each other. I was talking recently about this idea of spirituality. I don't mean in the religious sense. What I mean is that at one level, we know that we are essentially energy. That, you know, when we talk about people's spirits, we're talking about the sort of energy they have, that life force, you know, that animates our bodies and makes us live and breathe and be alive and think and feel. And we know that can be raised, it can be lowered. I mean, as it was with your daughter, if the conditions are wrong, we talk about people being in low spirits, or we talk about them being in high spirits. And it's what I'm getting at when I talk about being energized and energy being created by things we love and being diminished by things that bring us down. But there's also a sense in which we know that we feel other people's energies, that we are connected to other people through this energy field that we're part of. None of that stuff gets touched by the idea of an IQ test. I mean, some people want to go further than that. I mean, that's what I mean by spirituality. Some people want to go further and talk about spirituality in, you know, an ethereal sense, you know, in a supernatural sense or in a religious sense. Well, you know, we all have a view of that, and that's an area we should talk about some more. But the idea that intelligence only happens within our skull and traditionally on the left-hand side of it is patently nonsense. You know, it clearly our brains, I mean, you don't even have to say it, you know, are essential to our process of intellectual thought and awareness and being. I mean, take your brain out, I mean, it, you know, it puts you at a considerable disadvantage, frankly, socially. You know, but equally, a brain on its own sitting on the table isn't going to be much use to you. You know, we are complicated, sophisticated, organic processes in which all of our elemental parts contribute. People argue about the relative contributions they make. I mean, Cooper wants to argue strongly for what he calls, I think probably metaphorically, a brain in the gut. But we know what he's talking about. That our sense of empathy, our intuition, our gut feelings have a powerful role in how we come to think about the world. So that's really what I'm arguing for. You know, however it's framed or conceptualized, and more people contribute to our understanding of it, we have to think of ourselves holistically in terms of our feelings, spirituality, our intelligence, the range of our aptitudes, our sense of possibility. But more than that, we need to think about the way we relate to each other and our connections to each other, because I think the other argument in the element is that if you have aggregations of people who are detached from their talents, detached from a sense of purpose or meaning, you end up with what we often do have, which are dysfunctional communities. So this is a bigger argument than just about individuals. It's an argument about the health of our communities, and also, I think, it's a virtuous argument about what we need to face the future economically and culturally. But the point I just want to emphasize, and I think you're right about it, is that scholars from many different disciplines now are contributing to a common pool of understanding that we're much more than we were led to believe we were by our own education, and I think even by the intellectual traditions that we've grown up in.
You had talked in that about expanding our approach to the world. And for the last question of the day, I wanted to leave everyone with a perspective that you talk about in the book. And that's the little game, Are You Feeling Lucky, with the 5-pound note. Will you just share that story as the closing conversation?
Yeah. The little sequence I say for finding your element is, firstly, I get it, which is about attitude. I love it, which is about passion. I want it is about attitude, and where is it means you often have to go looking for these things. This is why people don't find their talent, because it's like natural resources. They're often buried deep. You have to go checking yourself out and finding opportunities. But the attitude thing is really important, because one of the reasons I realized as I've talked to people that some people are successful in pursuing the things they love to do is because they had a sense of determination about it. They felt open to the possibility. It's about attitude. It's about feeling that you deserve it and that you're willing to make the changes that may be needed. So, and there's a lot of research about this. You know, I spoke to people and they'd say, well, of course, I've been very lucky. And often people you speak to who aren't doing things they love will talk about not being lucky. Well, luck is an interesting idea. It sounds as if it's all about chance, but it isn't really. I mean, accidents happen to all of us. You know, lucky things, so to speak, serendipitous things happen to all of us. My point is, it's not what happens to you that makes a difference in your life. It's what you make of what happens to you. So that particular piece that you talk about is from a book called The Luck Factor by a psychologist called Gordon Wiseman, who set up experiments to see how different people responded. And one of them, he set up some people in a cafe and invited people to come in, allegedly to meet him there. People who'd said they'd been lucky in tests and people who'd said they'd been unlucky. And he set a few things up. He put a $5 note on the floor just outside the cafe. He sat somebody else in the cafe. Anyway, essentially what happened was that the people who were lucky, who said they were lucky, who identified themselves as lucky, more often than not saw the $5 note and picked it up before they went into the cafe. Sat there for a bit. If nobody spoke to them, they started speaking to the people in the cafe. Asked them if it was anybody's money, and if they'd said it wasn't, they hung on to it. But they made something of the situation. The people who said they were unlucky, more often than not, ignored the money, didn't see it, sat on their own in the cafe for 20 minutes, then left without speaking to anybody. And his point is that the same situation presented to different people with different attitudes turns into something different. That the crucial factor here is your own sense of expectation, your own sense of possibility, that you create luck as much as have it happen to you. And I think that's a crucial point in this, that the whole argument, really, of the element is that we are responsible in many ways for the lives that we create. And by discovering more about ourselves, we can recreate them into something that's more fulfilling for ourselves and the people and the communities that we're part of.
Beautiful. I'm in full agreement.
Thank
you. You're so beautiful when you talk. I just love it. And you speak, do you have a crazy travel schedule? Are you speaking all over the world still?
Yes, yeah.
Even more now with the book?
Yes, we've just done a tour for the book. It got to number 7 on the New York Times bestseller list, which I'm thrilled about.
Wow, that's so great. Congratulations.
And we've sold it now into translation into, I think, 10 languages.
Nice.
So, yeah, I feel very excited about this book. I think it's about something that's very important, and I'm very pleased at the response we've been getting to it. And I hope people listening will enjoy it and read it.
Everyone who is listening has enjoyed hearing about it. And I'm sure that we'll have a lot of people posting for the autographed copy, because it's not every day you can get a book from a man who's been knighted by the Queen, for God's sakes. And I do want to hark back to our first interview together, and I hope it's just one of many. where you told the story about what it was like to be knighted by the Queen. And that was such a great story, your visualization of the Beefeaters and the whole thing, that if anyone's listened to Sir Ken today and wants to hear more, that archived episode is still at personallifemedia.com. And you should definitely hear the stories that he tells. He's a name dropper extraordinaire as well. Paul McCartney, you name it. So the Queen is just the beginning. That's what makes you so darn fun, Ken.
Well, thank you so much, Susan. It's a real pleasure, as always.
Oh, yeah. It's been great to hear about your success, and I'm not surprised. And thanks for the work that you're doing in the world. It's really important. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right. I'm your host, Susan Bratton. You've gotten to know Sir Ken Robinson, author of a new number 7 on the New York Times bestseller list book called The Element. I hope you'll pick up a copy for yourself, and I hope you've enjoyed the show. Don't forget that if you want the autographed copy, you just go to DishyMixFan.com. And I wanted one final reminder to let you know that you can get notified every week when Dishy Mix goes live. You just have to go to PersonalLifeMedia.com and sign up. It just says notify me. You can click. It's a 1 second sign up. And you'll get a notification each week about what fabulous thing I have for you. So I hope you'll sign up for that. I hope you'll have a great day. I hope you learned something from Sir Ken. And I'll see you next week.
Find more great shows like this on personallifemedia.com.